Joe and Bruce have always kept their word to me. They've been honest. I've heard they've been nominated for an Oscar. I hope they win. I really do. It has caused the world to come together as one to fight for justice, and that I'm thankful for. He was telling me that I had to let go and go on with my life. And me telling him that I was as much in that ditch as my baby was, and not to tell me how to feel. I fought with him a lot. I was very angry at him, and I still feel anger towards him for not coming and letting me know that my son was missing.
Hello, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. This is Jim Clemente, former New York City prosecutor, retired FBI profiler and Criminal Minds writer and producer. And with me today is...
Laura Richards, former New Scotland Yard advocate, author, and founder and director of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service.
And I am Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds, where Jim Clemente is my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
Today, we're going to be continuing our discussion on the case known as the West Memphis Three, but we call it the Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills.
They're the murders of the 3 8-year-old boys, Christopher Byers, Michael Moore, and Stevie Branch.
Right. Most of the attention on this case actually has been focused on suspects and people they believed committed this crime. But we're continuing our discussion based on what actually happened at the crime scene, what kind of crime this was. What does the evidence tell us in terms of who committed this crime? Once we figure out the why and the how, that will lead us to the who.
And that's a really key part to this case. I think there's been so much in the narrative that has been inaccurate and misinformation, disinformation about what really happened. So it's important for us to take it right back. It's like peeling an onion, going right back to the crime scene and looking at what did happen, what did not happen, and going from the facts and the evidence that were to hand rather than what's been put out in the public domain that really did transform this case and that had serious repercussions for the type of person or persons who committed this crime. So should we just quickly remind our listeners just where we got to in terms of our first podcast? We talked about the injuries that were sustained in this particular
crime scene,
case.
Yes.
The crime scene, the geography.
Mm-hmm.
And we're going to talk a little bit more about the detail of that and what it tells us about the type of person or persons who committed the crime. So, you know, some of the significant things, I think, around the geography, which we just touched upon, was when you hear about this case and you understand it's in these woods, I actually thought this was a very isolated area. But actually, when you have the helicopter view of it, there was a sort of triangulation, that there was a truck stop, a main service road. So it would be very easy to get into these woods. But actually, for me, Jim, and I think this is something that we both agreed with, the actual area where the boys were found was quite secluded and isolated, which really did point to local knowledge.
Yeah, it's not that it was so far away from the beaten path, but it was very isolated. And because of that, somebody had to know that this would be a good area to dispose of these bodies. And clearly, they made an attempt at concealment, whether it was permanent concealment or very good temporary concealment. They actually spent some time on this concealment. And I believe that is an indicator in this case of who actually did it.
And that's an important point. You know, we certainly saw the two bikes that were taken out of the river and were on the side that led us, or certainly led me to believe, that the boys were already there in situ. So when we think about whether they were targeted somewhere else and then taken there, trying to control three of them is certainly a challenge. So it's highly likely that they were in situ there, and the person or persons who attacked and killed them then decided to conceal their bikes so that they wouldn't lead somebody to thinking, well, where are they and are they around this area?
Right, but then they would have searched that area thoroughly.
Absolutely.
So they wanted to prevent anybody from finding the boys' bodies quickly. And the fact is that it took time to do that. As we discussed in the earlier podcast,
Jim, if it takes time, then of course it heightens the risk
of
somebody spending time. So it has to be worth their time
exactly.
to stay there, to take that time, energy, and effort to conceal. And that concealment, which we mentioned in our other podcast, which was holding or putting weights to the bodies and trying to conceal the clothing as well, leads certainly me to opine that there's a personal connection in this case.
Yeah, sure. And the fact that somebody would go to that length to also hide the bikes means that they knew that if somebody saw these bikes, it would be recognizable as the bikes of these boys, and that would draw attention to that area. That's why they threw the bikes in the water as well. And they were hoping that nobody would ever find that. And but for the fact that maybe a sneaker happened to float by, somebody actually saw that, and that's what alerted them to the area. So they did a pretty good job of hiding the rest of the clothing, the three bodies, and two of the bikes. Now, I don't know whatever happened to the third bike, if there was a third bike.
I don't believe there was a third bike. I believe, I don't know if you want to skip ahead or whatever, but in one of the later documentaries, the two boys were together biking, and then the third boy was kind of looking around for them and left behind and had gone over to one of the houses looking for his friends. And the mom said, well, they're not here. They went off on their bikes. And then he left, and that was the last time that he'd been seen. So it doesn't sound like he had his bike.
Right. Well, maybe he didn't have his bike. Maybe he did. I don't know. But it's also possible that he caught up with them and they all rode off together, like a passenger on one
sure.
of the bikes. That happens all the time when you have 8-year-old kids. And so the important thing that I saw in terms of what the offender did at that time and place was that he used tools available to him there, not tools that he could have planned on, but the shoelaces of the children to actually tie them. And we talked before about how it wasn't traditional hog tying
that was reported on.
Right. It was actually right wrist to right ankle, left wrist to left ankle, and not hog tying. And because of that, that is not an effective way to actually control somebody who's alive. I think that was done out of convenience in order to keep them in a smaller space so that the concealment could be done. And I do not believe that it is a result of binding someone and torturing someone. Rather, it is a way to help in the disposal process.
Absolutely. And the other important thing is that it was shoelaces and not rope, because I've seen that reported on as well and talked about in various articles and media and at the court. It was their own shoelaces, the boys, which again, you can opine that whoever this was, the person or persons, did not go prepared
right.
to target, you know, with murder in mind, that
impulsive.
It was something that was impulsive that happened there and then.
Yeah, and I think four of the shoelaces were theirs, and I think one pair was the...
Correct.
From some
not
other
not identifiable
source.
And not from their own shoes. Yeah.
Right. So, obviously, this person did not plan on abducting and tying up three boys. This person obviously had to respond and react to a situation that developed. And it's possible that the offender came upon one of the boys or was with one of the boys, and the other two boys came upon the offender. And therefore, because of what was happening, these other two boys became witnesses and they were taken out because of it.
Well, there's a probability as well that perhaps the boys came upon the offender, perhaps, or
right.
offenders. Perhaps
saying,
they
yeah.
were the ones that witnessed something. Whatever that something was something with serious repercussions and consequences that then led to this explosive and impulsive rage or punishment situation that unfolded there and then. And I think that impulsive aspect, again, you would expect to see that in this person or person's everyday life course,
right.
that they respond quick to anger, quick to be impulsive and rage-filled, And you would see that in their everyday life. This isn't just something that's happened out of the blue. This is something that people would recognise in this person in daily interactions with significant others. So potentially, if they're in intimate relationships, you would expect to see, quick to rise, quick to be angry, impulsive, could be abusive, possibly abusive and violent. So again, these little things that are important, that when we look at the crime scene and we look at what was done to the boys versus what has been talked about in documentaries and at court, that people think that's really what happened to these boys, it actually changes the nature of the crime entirely.
Absolutely. And I think what's important, let's talk about the battery to the boys. I mean, they were physically assaulted. There's no question about that. And two of the boys died of drowning. And to me, what that tells me is that there was an assault, that these boys were unconscious, incapacitated, and they were tied up, and then they were thrown in the water.
Multiple skull fractures.
Right. And I don't believe that they were put in the water thinking that they would drown. I think that they were put in the water thinking that they were already dead. And that's something that happens all the time. When you have a massive trauma to the brain swells, it can really slow breathing down and really slow the heart rate down. And to somebody who's not an expert, they might think that the person is dead. And I believe that's probably what happened here. And even though they were put in the water as concealment, actually two of the boys died that way.
Right, and the bindings are superficial in many senses, although two of them did have defensive wounds on them. But I believe, too, that they were put in the water. And, of course, we didn't have too much around the detail of cause of death, other than blunt force trauma and being put in the water. One of them in particular, Chris Byers, didn't have any defence wounds, so it appears that perhaps he was unconscious when these bindings were put on him and he was put into the water. But people were looking for knives, for example,
right.
But there is no evidence of any knife wound to these boys, certainly of what we have seen in the autopsy report. So again, it changes the nature of the crime, that people think that this was that they were stabbed multiple times and then they're looking for the murder weapon that's the knife. Well, the blunt force trauma that was caused to their heads, it could be caused by a number of things. And actually, the weapon was never found. And I believe it was probably in that area, most likely, somewhere close-ish. But looking at the crime scene video, there were lots of bottles and things actually that were never collected within that crime scene location. So again, it goes down back to what was done at the crime scene, what was seized, who did the crime scene assessment, what they thought they were looking for versus what actually they were looking for. And of course, this was very quickly marked up and talked about as being some kind of satanic, ritualistic type of murder, where actually there was no evidence of that found at the crime scene. There were no Bibles, there were no candles, there was no paraphernalia to suggest that this was some sort of satanic,
right.
ritualistic murder.
That was all based on some kind of ridiculous misinterpretation of the physical evidence. And one thing that really, really burned me up in the trial was that the prosecution actually called what they called an expert witness in the occult to the stand. And that person got his master's and PhD without ever taking a single course.
So I mean, this is off the internet, getting certification.
Well, I think it might have been before the internet, but I think it was just a mail-in thing. And it had nothing to do with actual education. It wasn't a real master's. It wasn't a real PhD. He did not take a single course. And the judge allowed him to testify.
Exactly. What? And he said, he's a professional. He's an expert. Who are we to say he's not?
So then it gets marked up and people believe that this is
Absolutely.
Some kind of satanic, ritualistic. And, just to place it in its context, because there was a film that I really was very into that came out, a movie around this time, which was called The Lost Boys. And The Lost Boys had a huge kind of cult following.
I remember that movie, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's iconic, in its day and even now. And I listened to some of the music again from it yesterday, but it impacted hundreds of thousands of teenagers just in terms of what's in the present and the zeitgeist, this movie was in the zeitgeist, but everything that they felt they were looking for, which was some kind of satanic cult, they then wanted to make everything fit that. But in terms of what was found at the crime scene and how the boys, these little boys were found and their injuries and the absence of any paraphernalia, then, you know, I find it difficult to believe how they could make that assumption, because it is just that. It's assumptions
absolutely.
And speculations and conjecture as opposed to any evidence physically or otherwise to back it up.
Right. It was satanic panic. It had nothing to do with the facts of the case. It had everything to do with, well, if three boys are killed in this tiny little town, it has to be some big evil power that did this, as opposed to somebody from the town who they knew. And that would have been just an outrageous concept for them. Unfortunately, I believe it is somebody that they knew. I believe it is somebody that people in the town are very familiar with, that who felt totally comfortable in this town, who knew the area very well and knew that that was a good place to be hidden while he did something, and also to hide bodies.
And I believe it was someone who was high, well, there's a high probability that he could control the boys just through his very presence alone.
His authority.
Authority and, you know, some kind of element of control. And I would say it's through fear. Because actually, and Jim, you know this through the cases that you've worked. I mean, I can recall a number of cases, but to control one boy is a challenge, but to control two or three and adding, you know, more people into the situation, it becomes much more challenging and difficult, which leads me to believe that in this case that there was also an element of fear from the person that this was, of the personal connection in this boy. It may be one boy in particular, but in terms of their day-to-day life.
Right, and normally I would say that that means that the person had, the offender may have had a weapon, a knife or a gun to threaten them with. But there's absolutely no actual physical evidence that there was a knife or a gun involved. And because in that absence of evidence, we can't just assume that it was there. And so what other ways can a person control three children? And if that person is in an extreme position of authority, specifically with those kids, in other words, known to those kids and very much
revered and feared,
yes,
who has meted out punishment to them before, at least one of them, then that on its own can be enough to coerce and control. And, you know, we talk about this a lot just because, okay, you know, if we think that this is an adult child kind of crime, which this is, but we know from discussing and working with many, many cases that you don't have to have a physical weapon to gain control over a victim. It can be something that you say, it could be who you represent, who you are, that can gain compliance very quickly just by a look, by a threat. So there doesn't always need to be a physical weapon to be able to control. And I think, again, when we think about criminal sophistication, which you know, Jim and I will always look to in a crime like this, you know, there are some elements that might lead you to believe, well, this is someone who is criminally sophisticated because there's concealment. But actually, it's at a very rudimentary level.
Yes.
So I don't know your thoughts on that, Jim. It appears to me to be element, well, it's low criminal sophistication.
Yes. And I think the fact that they were found shortly thereafter tells me that that the person was not extremely sophisticated criminally or forensically. But also, the fact is that one other way to control somebody is by being in a position of authority to everyone. In other words, a law enforcement officer. The situation with this case, though, it's more likely to me that if it was somebody like that, it would have been somebody purporting to be a law enforcement officer. In other words, kids, you can see how kids would just listen and be direct if they were directed by somebody who was purporting to be a law enforcement officer. Mm. If it were an actual law enforcement officer, I would expect that person to have been much more criminally sophisticated than what's evinced here. And yes, you're right, and forensically sophisticated. And I don't see that here as well. So again, I believe this was not a crime that was planned out in advance. This is a crime of opportunity. I believe it went from possibly a crime against one of these children to a crime that was witnessed by two others who then were also taken in by this offender and killed. I do not believe that this was some kind of planned out event, particularly in light of the fact that these boys did travel together, but on this particular day, two of them were together and the other one had to find the third. And did he find the third, or did they find him after he was already in the clutches of this offender? To me, that's how it feels. And I believe that they came upon the scene of something horrible happening to this kid. They became witnesses, and they were killed because of that. And I think that that's why you see defensive wounds on those two kids, because they probably tried to run, they probably tried to fight, but I think the first child was already incapacitated at that time and did not have any ability to fight.
Question. How can you tell if it was one offender or two?
Well, that's a good question. And to control three kids, generally...
That's what I keep thinking. I'm like, I can't get my kids to go take a bath, you know, without chasing one or the other. I mean, how could one person do this?
But they know you, and they know you're not going to hurt them physically.
No,
you're
but
not
I have
going
authority
to kill
over them.
Them
for sure.
Yeah,
you know?
But they know you're not going to kill them. And
fear
they can get,
of the consequence.
They've tested you a bunch of times, I believe, right?
Yeah.
They didn't start out like that, right? Mm-hmm. They got more and more emboldened over time, right?
Mm-hmm.
Well, these kids probably didn't have that opportunity. This was a one-shot deal. They were faced with grave danger, and they probably complied to a certain extent. And at that point, the offender attacked, and they tried to fight back, but they lost. So I would say the offender or offenders, I'm not saying that it's one, certainly, but it could be done by one. If one of the kids was already controlled and maybe unconscious by the time the other two kids showed up, and then that offender had enough gravitas and was able to incite enough fear in the other two that he could control them just by the threat of either doing something harmful to them or getting them in trouble. Kids can be really easily controlled with the thought of being in trouble. Maybe they weren't supposed to be where they were. Maybe they were doing something they weren't supposed to be doing. Maybe this whole thing started as a punishment and it got out of hand. But it does not appear to be some kind of targeted, stalking event where they hunted down these kids and killed them. It's more of a personal cause homicide, something that got out of control, a rage-filled homicide that was not planned in advance, but whoever did it tried very hard to conceal the bodies because it was important to spend the time with the bodies because there was a known relationship between that person and the victims.
Which also tells us there's a time window. Whoever this was, you know, it had to be back to also be alibied. And I do think that, you know, from what we know, that this there's a high likelihood that this is somebody who certainly has that personal connection, but has had some kind of interaction with law enforcement and does understand, you know, that it's worth taking that time, i.e. taking the clothes off of the boys and concealing those that could possibly point to that this is a predatory sort of stranger related sex attack. And that takes you off in a completely different direction. You know, there was certainly no paraphernalia there to show that it was some kind of ritualistic, but that's what law enforcement jumped to straight away. But there is the other aspect that, you know, is this a predatory serial killer targeting little boys? Particularly when you add in what was said about, you know, one of them, Christopher Byers, being castrated and skinned, you know, more the castration making it sound like that this is a targeted sex attack too. Although, Jim, you did mention in our last pod that you couldn't rule out necessarily, you know, we don't always know with the, just because we don't see something overtly sexual that it's not sexually motivated. But in this case, I do not believe it is sexually motivated. I believe it's something that unfolded very quickly. That was not in the person's mind at that time, but it was a response, a reaction to a situation, and then they are trying to hide what has happened.
Yeah, I think that if it was sexually motivated, it was probably sexually motivated against the first of the three victims, and the other two became witnesses, and that's a reason why they might have been killed. And I think that taking off the clothes was actually a forensic countermeasure. By taking off the clothes, maybe there were some of the offender's evidence on them, but I think more likely the offender was putting them in water, and he probably knew that there were
critters in there.
Yeah, critters in there. And so decomp would start faster and critters would start, unfortunately, consuming the body. But that would be, that's the way that he intended it to be permanent concealment, that he put it in a stream that was filled with snapping turtles that were doing a lot of biting at that time of year. And people in the area know that that's what happens at this time of year. So I think he took off the clothes with the express purpose of trying to help get rid of these bodies. And it almost worked. What it did do, though, was it gave these, you know, satanic panic people an avenue to go after a particular type of offender that really had nothing to do with this case.
So it could well have been, you know, an intentional act. You know, I still believe that the local knowledge element is important, because knowing those woods and the streams and these, I mean, I've not heard of snapping turtles.
Oh, really? They're... I met a very, very angry one when I was a kid. I mean, the shell was about 2.5 feet long. And it was literally, like, if you would catch a fish, this thing would come up and just bite the whole, like, swallow the whole fish and just bite it right off of your hook. I mean, it was just very aggressive. And it had killed a bunch of ducks on the lake where I was staying. And it was like a little monster in there. It was very vicious. And snapping turtles can be incredibly voracious. So I believe that the offender was trying to take advantage of that in this particular area. And again, like you said, that speaks of local knowledge.
It does. I mean, that's an interesting point. You know, if it's as a forensic countermeasure, or whether it's a case trying to distract attention and make it look like it's something sexual. But it's interesting that that didn't go through law enforcement's head. If they had knowledge of that area and knew that there were, you know, critters and these snapping turtles, etc., why were they not looking at some of those injuries as possibly being caused by the critters and animals?
See, at the Behavioral Analysis Unit, we had our own version of the body farm, in which we used fetal pigs and young pigs to actually replicate what children's bodies go through when they're in the wild.
Because you're testing the hypotheses, and you're trying to understand what it looks like.
And then there's the body farm, in which they actually study. People donate their bodies so that they can be placed in different types of scenarios out in the environment, so that we can learn, document that, learn from those, and then when we see evidence on a body or how a body gets dismantled by critters, we call it critter activity, that will actually help us reconstruct a crime and a crime scene and a disposal site. So these are very important things that, unfortunately, they were resources that this set of law enforcement officials didn't reach out to. And if they had, I think they would have found right away that their theory was radically wrong. And I think they wouldn't have made such a huge mistake in terms of the direction of this investigation.
I mean, all the talk about it, I mean, the symbols that you see wrote everywhere. I mean, which it could be just kids writing things, I don't know. I mean, but there's just too much talk about it for it not to be true.
Just one other thing I want to say about the crime scene that we haven't mentioned yet, and it comes up in the later documentaries, is how incredibly cluttered this creek was. It wasn't just this nice, pristine, clear country creek. It was full of junk. It was full of litter and trash and all different kinds of things. And, you know, how do they know what's significant and not to pick up? And there's all kinds of contamination that could have happened in there. Mm-hmm. It was just very interesting to see later what was actually in that creek that they're walking through.
Yeah, I did think they did one good thing. And I saw in some of the crime scene video that they had put sandbags up. And I believe they pumped out the water from the area where the boys' bodies were so they could see the bodies in situ, so they could see actually how they were in there. Now, I think one of them had already been taken out and put up on the bank, but the other bodies, I think, were still there. And I think that that was a very smart move. Now, whether or not they pumped out all that water and didn't go through the water that they pumped out, I don't know. Because if they just pumped it out and it went somewhere else, it's unfortunate because they probably lost a lot of good evidence.
And that's always a challenge with a case like this, you know, clearing the ground from underneath your feet and knowing, you know, what went on, what's relevant, what's not, and having people interpret it for you who are true experts in what they do. And of course, in this case, none of that happened. Even the experts, in inverted commas, that they bring in at court, you know, are very interesting and concerning in terms of their credibility, but they'd already gone off down a certain track. And I think it's important when people keep talking about the bloody crime scene, you know, well, what happened? They must have been attacked somewhere else because there wasn't a huge amount of blood, that clearly they're not coming from a position of understanding or knowledge, that this was not a bloody crime scene. These were boys who were attacked, blunt force trauma to the head. They had multiple skull fractures, and two of them died from that and from being drowned. So, and there was no knife or you know, stab wounds involved, so that this would not have been a bloody crime. So you wouldn't expect to see huge amounts of blood on whoever it was, the person or persons. And you also have to consider which are the wounds, the injuries that they get post-mortem. And if it's post-mortem, then you're not going to be seeing as much blood because the heart stopped pumping. And if they're submerged in water too, then obviously what blood there is will be diluted and carried away in the stream.
Right, and I think one of the boys exsanguinated. I don't know for sure because I'm not sure if the autopsy was done properly. I don't know. I certainly know that they didn't. That whoever did the autopsy did not have an extensive amount of experience doing crime scenes and crime autopsies like this. But one of the boys had a gash on his head and certainly wounds that they believe, they interpreted as his penis being skinned. Later, it was obviously determined that that was wrong. That was just, that was critter activity, much like the bites all over their bodies were. It's simply a matter of being out in the wilderness with animals that can feed on dead people. So, Laura, to me, the fact that the bikes were very nearby, the fact that the bodies were all in this river or stream, tells me that the crime, the assault, occurred very nearby. Because there were three boys to transport and two bikes, I do not believe that that was done over a great distance. I believe that it was done close to this secluded area, if not right there in this secluded area. However, I do not believe that there was a bloody scene, like you said, on the bank, and that they splashed up water to wash it away. It makes no sense. There's no other indications of that kind of criminal sophistication and the ability to get rid of all blood if there was blood from the one victim who exsanguinated. I just don't believe that happened. I think that happened. I think that person bled out in the water, and that's what actually resulted in him exsanguinating. And there's just no evidence at all of this theory that the prosecution seemed to put out, that there was this ritualistic crime that occurred in which these kids were tortured over a period of time. It just doesn't exist.
I think it's highly unlikely. I mean, the prosecution did describe it as a satanic ritualistic homicide, and yet there are no markers of that at all at this crime scene. We discussed it in the Meredith Kircher case as well. There was no. We've seen cases where there's ritualistic and satanic worshipping behaviours, and there's paraphernalia left. There's clear indicators of that. But in this case, there is an absolute absence, and that's important. And of course, you know, whoever this is, the person or persons, you are talking about three boys, they're 8 years old, so there would be weight there in terms of having to carry and move from, you know, a potential abduction site to control them, to then kill them somewhere else, to then dispose of them somewhere else, and their bikes. You know, this is a huge, an awful lot of things that someone would have to do. So I believe the boys' bikes were thrown in the water where they were left, whether the boys came upon this person or persons, you know, I believe that could be, you know, highly likely. But so too is the offender or offenders was having an interaction with one of them and then the other two appeared. But it certainly was something that dynamically unfolded. It was something that was not planned. There wasn't pre-preparation, planning, targeting, predatory stalking behaviour. This stuff happened really in the blink of an eye. When the boys were last seen, and it's that window, I believe, from 5:30 to 6:45, trying to place the boys, you know, they were last seen going off into the woods. And, you know, the police should really have been trying to look for the exact sequence of events, when they were last seen and by whom. Right. Talking to everybody in that local community, because I too believe this is distinctly local. This is someone right. who is known to the boys, known well to the boys, who I think he can control them through his voice, through what he says, through fear and terror, that these boys were terrified and terrorized to the point, you know, they feared for their lives, and quite rightly so, because as things unfolded, they were no match for whoever this person was. But it's not criminally sophisticated or forensically so, although there are aspects of that which does make me understand or believe that there are elements where this individual has had contact with law enforcement for other types of crimes that they may have committed, and they would be known for explosive rage. And that would be in their significant relationships, and those who are not significant to them would also see these flashes of quick to rise, quick to anger, will be able to convince you that it was one thing rather than another, who would show no remorse, who could quite easily be have the audacity to stand and make out that they had nothing to do with this and be able to play along with this kind of, you know, they're the Jekyll and Hyde kind of character. The type of people that I've spent a lot of time studying, that they appear to be one thing when it suits them, but behind closed doors, they're something quite different.
Well, we should get into who they decided was responsible for these crimes and how they went about trying to prove that.
But one of the teenagers, Jesse Miskelly, borderline mentally disabled with a documented low IQ, confessed after 4 hours of police interrogation, implicating his friends.
How did it start? How did they end up focusing on these three guys who would eventually become known as the West Memphis Three?
Well, it starts with that whole satanic ritual aspect that the police thought this crime had, and it sent them into the wrong direction. And unfortunately, the first place they stopped was Jerry Driver, who was in charge of a number of juvenile delinquents in the town. And that's where it started.
And we've got to remember, at the time in this town, there was a huge amount of pressure for law enforcement to resolve this murder. And, you know, the local community were gripped by fear, and they wanted somebody to be found accountable for this. And so that created a lot of pressure for law enforcement.
Right. In a town this small, under 30,000 people.
And the other thing, just to let our listeners know, is that the documentary jumps straight into the suspects. And we decided not to on Real Crime Profile, because that's not something that Jim and I would do normally. You wouldn't start the case by looking at the individuals that are believed to have committed the crime. So you want to stay as true to understanding the facts and the evidence. And it is a challenge with this documentary, because obviously right from the start, it jumps in with, you know, Jesse Miskelly and Damien Eccles and Jason Baldwin. So that's why we did our profile up front. And now we'll talk about what happened with the investigation, because that's really the key part to this.
You Absolutely. Know,
the investigation, what they thought this type of crime, the type of person or persons who would have committed it, the sort of the rumour, the speculation, the conjecture, the fact that the media were in to this case right from the start, and this documentary maker HBO were in there with their cameras right from the start, which does change and distort things.
Yes. And I think if we start with Jesse Miskelly. So Jesse Miskelly is a 17-year-old boy at this time, and he has about a 72 IQ. Already, we're starting to see parallels between this case and Brendan Dassey's case.
I just felt that right from the start.
Right from the start, yeah.
And certainly once they start to talk about him and his family members and, you know, the interviews with law enforcement and just some of the interactions, you know, when you're seeing him talk.
Yeah, it's clear that he is in way over his head, doesn't understand the situation, doesn't understand even what he's saying. And right from the start, he has a very tight alibi. He was out of the area at a wrestling match when this crime took place. So that should have been confirmed immediately, and it should have undermined the entire theory that they purported after this. But if you actually look at his, quote, confession, and I'm doing the air quotes or the inverted commas. They showed him a picture of one of the victims to shock him. But it also gave him information, I mean, which is just the wrong thing to do. He got the boy's name wrong. He said that the murders took place around noon, and then they kept asking and they kept revisiting the time and over and over and over again, 8 times until he finally got it right.
The suggestibility was just outrageous, and putting words into his mouth the whole way through.
Right, but to say, he says at noon, wait, you sure about that? Couldn't have been later. Keep going 8 times before he finally hits on it, and then say, yeah, you got it right. Yay, we'll lock onto that. And we will ignore completely the fact that you thought it happened at noon. Yeah. So there's that.
Also see, though, from his interactions with his dad, he's also a boy, and I'm saying boy intentionally, because he comes across as quite childlike.
He does, very simple kid.
Very simple in his interactions, very simplistic view on life and the world, and you can see he acquiesces to authority. So that, you know, someone acquiescing and wanting to please and wanting to get to the right answer, again, is what we saw with Brendan Dassey, but it is just a mirror image here,
right,
of that particular case. And, you know, he has a very simplistic view, and you can see that he's under pressure and he just wants to give what he deems to be the right answers.
Yeah, but...
And they have him for hours before they even start recording his story. So to me, that just rings all kinds of alarm bells to me. I don't know if it did
right.
to you.
Well, I mean, I can just say in law enforcement, that's not unusual. Mm-hmm. I mean, the FBI may now record all their interviews, but it was a very strong policy that the FBI did not record any of its interviews, that they put on the FBI agent's shoulders the incredibly difficult task of accurately documenting everything that was said during an interview without a recording. And that, to me, is asinine. I'll call out the FBI. It is asinine. I had conversations with the director when I was in the FBI about it, and I think it's ridiculous. And to protect the rights of citizens, everything should be recorded from the first sentence that's said between a suspect and the cops, as well as it protects the cops from allegations that they're doing something wrong. And if they do something wrong and it's documented, then they should learn from that. And they will ruin cases because of that. So they have to make sure that they're doing it right every time. But what's incredibly obvious to me for all of the Jesse interviews is that he adds absolutely no information that the police didn't have. Police don't have all the information, right? They have a certain amount of information they've collected at the crime scenes and so forth, and the timeline that they've been able to put together. But that's filled with gaps. And you should, during the course of the interrogation of somebody, if they're confessing, you should be able to get a number of details that you just haven't found yet. But there's none of that in this case, just absolutely none of it. And they're
giving more information to him. I mean, it's working the other way around.
And feeding it back to them.
Exactly. He's just parroting back. You know, the thing with the ropes and the shoelaces.
Right. He said rope, and actually they were tied with shoelaces. Well, that's a very different thing.
And that's the challenge here, that they ignore the inaccuracies as well. So they really do have, you know, blinders on, and they just want to ensure that everything that he says fits.
Right, it's confirmation bias.
It is, and the suggestibility. I mean, there was one exchange which I'll recall. I actually wrote it down because I just thought it was very interesting, where Detective Ridge said, so when did you go with them? And Jesse says, morning. And he then says, Detective Ridge, I'm not saying what time they called you. When were you in the park? And Jesse says, about noon. And Detective Ridge says, OK, was it after school let out? And starts to suggest that it was later, and Jesse says yes. And Detective Ridge then follows up, says, OK, the night you were in the woods, had you all been in the water? And Jesse says, yeah, we'd been in the water. We'd been in that night. So now he's actually putting words into his mouth.
He's gone from morning to night by saying the night you were in the woods, when his former statement was morning and noon, and now it's night.
And without him even knowing, and this is what we would say, you know, is pressure, suggestion, and manipulation.
Right. It's leading the witness in a way that is absolutely incomprehensibly wrong in this situation, because you're dealing with somebody you obviously know does not have the mental acuity to fight that. And you just demonstrated his suggestibility by saying that to him, and he doesn't challenge it. This is one of the ways we test whether children are actually capable of giving sworn testimony. We give them a situation, and we throw in a dichotomy. If they don't call it out, we know that they don't really know the difference between right and wrong, what happened, what didn't happen, and it makes them not a good witness. And we have to document that, and then we have to show the other side if we put them on the stand, so that we're responsibly putting people on the stand that are going to give accurate, hopefully accurate information. Clearly, this kid could not do that.
Yeah, and that's just one of many, many examples of right. his statement that were just handed to him by the police, led by the, I mean.
Right, and it calls to mind Brendan Dassey saying to his mother when she said, why did you tell the police all those things? And he said, I just made them up. She goes, where did you even get that information? He goes, I guess, just like I do my homework.
They want the pressure to end, and so we'll say something on a short-term level to get out of a situation, and they just see it as a short-term and that it will get figured out later on, but of course it doesn't. And in Brendan Dassey's case, yeah, it's kind of being figured out now, but look at the consequence, and the same in this particular case. So, you know, it's really challenging watching some of this material, and the alibi, I think, is even more strikingly important. He right. actually had an alibi. Numerous people. And what's the probability of all of them getting together and lying when they were all found very early on, and yet they're not used at any point in terms of the trial?
No, because they put blinders on. They didn't want to know the truth. They wanted to convict this guy because he's the one that gave them the other two. Right. And unfortunately, because he was so suggestible, because they were targeting specific types of people, they asked him about his friends and who he hung out with. And of course, that would have been Damien Echols and Jason Baldwin. Unfortunately for them, they were friends with a very probably nice guy, but not the brightest bulb in the pack.
Well, I think in the beginning, he wasn't even talking about this Jason Baldwin, because there were two Jason Baldwins
That's right.
living very near each other, two very different looking guys, one big, huge guy who had quite a record, and then Jason Baldwin, the thin teenager. And if you look through the transcripts or the police reports, it's clear that everybody's confused about who's talking about who. And this just seems like a hallmark of the case of misstatements, misidentifications, mischaracterizations, a huge game of telephone going from one person to the other. And so many of the quote-unquote witnesses or confidential informants that the police have, they're just stories that just keep getting twisted right. from children.
Are they
children
even stories or are they rumors? You know, and there's mm-hmm. it's like that Chinese whisper thing, but, you know, I wouldn't even call them stories. I would call these rumors that are just mm-hmm. handed down and around, and very clear mistaken identity, you know, on numerous occasions, actually, not just one. Mm-hmm. So when we go back to the investigation, you know, it is riddled with problems.
Yeah, are you actually calling it an investigation, Laura?
Well, I should have said putting, my inverted commas.
Yeah, there you go.
Because this wasn't a proactive investigation.
No, it
this
wasn't.
Was a reactive response to try and go with the principle of least effort in many senses, and to go with what they might think is just the most obvious thing. But, you know, the alibi is a major problem when you've got others who actually had no alibi and were never interviewed.
Right.
That tells you everything, in the sense that they really had no idea what they were doing.
Okay.
And it goes back to the basic standards and basic principles of an effective investigation, which never happened from the outset.
Right.
What would you do in a legitimate investigation?
Well, you start with the people closest to the victims. especially when you're talking about children of this age. So we were able to do a study of all the child abduction homicides in the United States over a 10-year period. And what we found was the age of the victim really had a strong correlation with the relationship between the victim and the offender. And the younger the victim, the more likely that it was someone known to them. So you would start with the family. You would interview every single member of the family, both if there are split families, which there is in every one of these cases. I believe there's a parents and step-parents and two homes that they would go to and so on and so forth. You would interview every single one of them, and you'd find out what those people were doing first. And then you make concentric circles outward in extended family and friends, people they interact with at school, and so on and so forth. Who are they exposed to? That's who the main suspects should be. And their misinterpretation of the evidence and their blinders that kept them focused on some bizarre theory of satanic torture were absolutely red herrings. So they should have interviewed the family members. Had they done so immediately, they would have probably solved this case.
And you're right. And just to give context to that, you know, so there is science behind this and research. In the UK, a child dies every 10 days at the hands of a parent. And that's by our NSPCC, our National Society for the Protection of Children. And it's exactly why, you know, in cases that we look to the home, first of all, the domestic situation, and ask questions about the dynamics and who's doing what, who's where, what the relationships are like, you know, the detail that in this situation only came out much later on through the documentary, but was never asked about at the time of this investigation.
In the quote, investigation. Now, for example, one of the parents was working at this time, right? The mother was working. When she comes home, she finds out that her son never came home. She was like, well, why didn't you tell me? Why isn't there a huge alarm raised? I would be asking that father or stepfather who didn't report it, why? Why is it that there isn't a massive manhunt now for this child? And then to find out there's two other children who are also missing, that's a major issue. Why wasn't that information given out to all the cops in the neighborhood? Why wasn't there an APB to look out for these kids? Why weren't searches started immediately? When you have kids that young, they're 8 years old. I mean, they're in danger being out in the wild overnight. And that's something that they didn't think to do, apparently.
Well, two of the fathers claim that they were out searching for them all night from about 6 p.m. until late,
but
I believe.
Why didn't they call the police, or did they call the police?
There was a phone call to the police, but I believe the police didn't respond. They had one police officer out searching, and it was in the morning that one of the other families called up and asked, you know, why they're not responding, why aren't they helping with the search? And of course, then we've got these critical windows of time that we've talked about, the 44% of missing children being dead in the first hour, the 73% in the first three, and then the 99% in the 24. So it's really important. You know, this is 24 hours later. It has an impact on the crime scene, as we've discussed. And the other thing, you know, to mention is that, you know, through research, we also know that step-parents, you know, in blended families, there's also an increased risk to the woman and the child of abuse. So again, once you start layering in the research that sits behind, you know, what Jim and I do, then you start to really, you can prioritise your lines of investigation, your lines of inquiry, and it's all about priorities at this critical time, the golden hours as things are unfolding. And, you know, matched against, I have to say, you know, I picked up immediately on Stevie's mum's interview, because there was just that moment where she says, and it's the one that we talked about before, where you're seeing sort of the behind the scenes of the interview, but one of the things that she says is, I wasn't at home, but it wasn't my fault, you know, which again for me is just a bit of leakage, which signals that there's something going on at home. You know, it's very rare for a parent to say that right from the start. And, you know, it can be something or it can be nothing, but you would want to follow that up and ask questions about the dynamics of the household.
And to answer your question, we do have the child abduction response plan that's available for law enforcement through the Behavioral Analysis Unit of the FBI, and any law enforcement officers listening out there, you can get a copy of that or copies of that for everyone in your command so that you'll know what to do during situations like this. For others, the OJJDP, that's the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, does publish a list of steps for first responders to incidents like this, and we will post the link on our website so that everybody can check that out. But it gives a very detailed list of things to do and what kind of evidence to gather, what kind of questions to ask, so that you'll be able to respond positively and make sure that you're asking the right questions and getting the right information right from the start, because children's lives are at risk, at extreme risk, if they are abducted.
So one thing I want to talk about is how Jesse Miskelly even came into that room in the first place to be questioned. And it all stems back, once again, to this misidentified satanic ritual, which just burned a hole through every person in that town and led everybody to be chattering about it, gossiping about it, you know, pointing fingers and, you know, retelling tales. And it reminds me of a murder that happened near where I grew up, and they also made a movie out of it, River's Edge, which was based on the murder of Marcy Conrad. So this happened in a small neighboring town called Milpitas, where a girl was murdered and her body was left in the hills, and teenagers would drive up and look at her body, and nobody ever told law enforcement.
Wow.
And they later made a movie about out of that called River's Edge. But I'd heard about that. I mean, that made its way to my town, and it just got bigger and bigger and bigger. And so I can see that in this same situation, the rumors are flying. And
it was distorted when the information got to you, right?
Sure, sure. It was distorted. But it was also, it was like I don't want to say thrilling. Thrilling's not the right word. But it was like, oh, my God, this happened here. And it just led to all different kinds of, like, who knew and who'd seen and do you know the guy?
Some people want to be relevant.
Yeah.
And so they get involved. And they say they knew something or they heard something 15th hand from somebody else and they adopt it as their own and say, yes, I was a witness to that too.
Yeah.
When it's completely false. And it seemed that in this particular investigation, that kind of stuff was just consumed voraciously.
Right.
And community intelligence does have its place. And, you know, I've worked on lots of operations where we rely on community intel, but it's who's the source?
Right.
You know, where's it coming from? Is it reliable? You know, we grade our intelligence and our information, and it, you know, is it just rumor and conjecture, or actually does it have worth? Is it information for action? And so all of that should be sifted through by proper intelligence operatives, intelligence analysts, intelligence field officers. But I think in this case, they were just awash with people speculating, gossiping, and just rumors.
And that a lot of the police's actions were based on a story that a teacher overheard by a child who was retelling another child's story on and on and on. And they just never actually got to the truth, but instead used those rumors
to focus the investigation?
To confirm the bias they already had.
Right, right. And so instead of actually going with the evidence they had, they went with theories that obviously focused on rumor and innuendo. And unfortunately, that is not solid evidence. And especially, we've often talked about the fact that eyewitness testimony is the least reliable testimony. Ear witness testimony is even less reliable. And when you're talking about kids and a small town and people wanting to get involved and there's some sort of buzz about this case and obviously some real fear, everybody wants to put away the monsters, quote, who did this. So everybody wanted to be involved. And especially when you're talking about a bunch of children giving this, quote, evidence, it creates a problem. And it did in this case.
So just to tell you how convoluted this whole story got. So a fourth grade teacher in a nearby town informed the police that a student of hers, Loretta Smith, told her that Michelle Eilenberg said that her brother, Damien Eilenberg, was the murderer. And the music teacher from the same school reported that four of her five students said that the murderer was somebody named Damien, who changed his name from Michael, who was a Satanist or a devil person. So at the end of the day, they had one person named Michael Eilenberg, and that person was then misidentified as Damien Eccles. And they even had the picture of the two of them together, and one of law enforcement misidentified Damien Echols as Michael Eilenberg. I mean, that is so convoluted just to explain, and I can't even tell you. It's just like one out of many things that happened in this case.
And clearly kept law enforcement going down on that confirmation bias road and not allowing them to actually look at the evidence and see where it actually takes them. It's just, it's a shame, and I can tell you from my experience that it happens when there is a highly charged emotional investigation, and this ranks among the highest of the kinds of cases that would get law enforcement officers really emotionally charged and stop them from actually doing what is a legitimate investigation and go simply based on emotion.
And of course, you know, this is these sorts of cases, yes, they can be emotionally charged, but it's really about managing a large scale of information and intelligence. And of course, when you're, you know, the senior investigating officer, you've got to be adept at managing a huge amount of information and intelligence coming at you. And you've got to be very skilled at being able to work out what is, you know, critical information to be prioritized. And if you're looking for the wrong person and the wrong type of criminal, it's going to have very serious repercussions. And keeping an open mind right from the start is so important. Mm-hmm. And yet we didn't see this in this case, along with many others that we have discussed. So, you know, the skill set of a senior investigating officer is a really important one, but it is about managing a large-scale investigation with lots of intelligence and information.
Okay, so we'll have much more next time.
Yeah, and I can't wait to talk about one of my favorite subjects attached to this case, Brent Turvey.
Oh, yeah, we'll get to that next time.
I think it's going to be very interesting, and certainly there's some key elements of profiling in inverted commas, which again had a significant impact and consequence on this case. So we're going to get into that on the next episode. So thank you very much to our Real Crime Profile listeners, and tune in into our next pod. Real Crime Profile signing out. So if you enjoy our podcast and would like to support us, there are a couple of important things you can do. First, you can go over to iTunes and give us a positive 5-star review. You can check out our sponsors and take advantage of the special promotions for Real Crime Profile listeners. You can go over and like our Facebook page, and you can follow us on Twitter. But most importantly, you can share our podcast with friends, family, and anyone you know would be interested in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes. So thank you for listening.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter, or counseling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website, www.genesisshelter.org, or the domestic violence hotline on 800-799-7233.